Yes.
What do you do with the objection that there are some things too minute and common to make a difference, such as washing dishes? Is there a Christian way to wash dishes? Or is that...
Yes, cheerfully. It's not that. Let's say a non-Christian figured out the best way to wash a dish, right? That's the way God wants you to learn. God wants you to do it cheerfully, and He wants you to do it effectively and efficiently, remembering other things. Let's say your kid needs you. It may be best to wash the dish inefficiently for the sake of your daughter. You know, that's why you have to have a hierarchy of values and understand what God requires, what's the greater and what's the lesser, and that sort of thing. But I would say that the God who made the galaxies, and the God who holds each atom together, and the God who knows the position and current velocity of every electron in the universe, is not above telling us how to wash the dishes. So Jesus says, the hairs of your head are all numbered. Not one sparrow falls to the ground apart from the will of the Father. So we can't scrunch down into this little cubbyhole and say, what I'm doing here is of no interest to God. So I want to maintain that every square inch of your life, everything you do, washing a dish, wiping the table, finding a parking place, watching your neighbor's kid, all of those things are things that God looks on with pleasure or displeasure. And we are grateful that He does so, as I emphasized in the first talk, as a gracious God. He's not looking on with pleasure or displeasure because He's trying to figure out a way to get us. But he's looking on what we're doing, and so when we offer it up to Him, He receives it with pleasure. So I think very strongly that everything I do, I ought to be figuring out, I ought to be thinking, how can I do this to please God? And oftentimes it's a routine task that all that's necessary to please Him is to be wanting to please Him.
Yes.
What do you think about with regard to liturgical acts, gestures? There's a number of those things that are essentially universal. And it goes from what you mentioned, the hand of the flesh, and the civic thing, standing for the national anthem, shaking hands is another. And then within church, you know, the raising of the hands, bowing the head, kneeling, physical gestures like that. Some of which I think for us are new and different. We're starting to do them now, whereas coming up we did, like the raising of the hands, some of the repetition that you spoke of, kneeling. What do you mean by expanding those and adopting other universal or essentially universal gestures like crossing yourself?
Well, the reason crossing yourself would be so controversial is because it's not anywhere near universal, right? Because there's a great divide in between the Roman Catholic world and the Eastern world and Protestantism. Calvin didn't have a problem with crossing yourself, and it can be done. I don't have any inherent objection to it. But one of the things I believe that Protestant Christians ought to be sensitive to is this just going to be different, or is it going to look Catholic to your sister-in-law who grew up Catholic, became a Christian after many years, was persuaded to start coming to your church, and is going to freak out when people start doing that? Well, a Christian worldview doesn't just answer the question in terms of, if it's a universal practice, you don't have the problem. If it's controversial, you've got a problem, and if it's something that you think would be really valuable to introduce, like I think, for example, crossing yourself isn't in the Bible, but kneeling for confessions, kneeling in worship is in the Bible. So I would want to encourage Christians to institute the reform of
kneeling for, let's say, a confession of sin, I think that's a good thing to do, and worth it trying to institute that slowly over time, bringing people along. And the reason I go slowly is because I've got a Christian worldview. I'm loyal to them and to the text. I'm loyal to the catechesis. I think we ought to be kneeling at this point. And I'm also loyal to the people and to the narrative and the story that I'm in. But throwing the church into a commotion for something that the Bible doesn't require is not something I'm willing to do. Although, it wouldn't give me great heartburn if I found myself in a community of Christians doing it and it wasn't controversial and they weren't being superstitious or anything like that. Did I answer your question? Yes?
In a mission-oriented context, we want to share the gospel of Jesus Christ, and the worldview in which we understand that gospel is infiltrated with a lot of other shared elements with the culture that we grew up in that are not necessarily a part of that gospel message.
Right.
And so when we share and we're dealing in another culture, how do we make the decision for them or teach them to make the decision as to what in their culture they have to jettison in order to take on the story of the gospel of Jesus Christ?
That's a great question. I would answer it this way. There are the things that a missionary would go over and demand that they drop. There are the things that he would never dream of demanding that they drop. But if they listen to him and respect him, they probably will. It's not sinful, but of some cultural element that they would begin wanting to be like him. And so the Western culture would begin to supplant the native culture. But what was supplanted is not necessarily sinful at all. And it would be done voluntarily on the part of the native population. And then there is, I would say, the ideal that has been given to us by anthropologists, which is actually the dictum of science, that you can go into a tribe and study them and get to know them without changing anything. Right? That's the ideal of the anthropologist, which the missionary can't do. The whole point of the missionary is to go over there and change things. And so I would want to argue that God is a lot less fastidious about things like this than we tend to be. It's easy to make fun of going over there and putting neckties on natives. And there are bizarre manifestations of westernization that we could identify and make fun of. But I don't see, when Jesus says, preach the gospel to every creature, he's presupposing cross-cultural communication. And there's no way I could go to another country without tracking a lot of America with me. It's just going to happen. My son-in-law is studying at Oxford now with my daughter and their five kids, and they were talking to some Englishman over there and who was complaining about the awful state of Christian education there. And it's just not... it was just appalling. They were complaining about it. And Ben, my son-in-law, said, well, why don't you start a school? And they said, that is so American. he was thinking, you're complaining about the problem, so why don't you do something about it? Right? And we would think that's an innocent remark, but they instantly identify that as an American characteristic. Well, you can imagine in Korea and Indonesia, that'd be multiplied 100 times over. And I think God doesn't care. Go ahead.
Follow up with that. What do you do then when you have the community of world Christianity trying to come together to evangelize the world, and you have well-established churches in radically different Eastern and Western cultures trying to figure out what it means to have unity in Jesus Christ, when not so much the color of garden hoses differ, but the very things that we would go to Scripture and consider to be central elements of the truth of Scripture and the truth of faith are different. do radically different.
That's a great argument for not forming a joint mission society together with them, because you're going to have instant paralysis. I think what you have to do is say, okay, these divisions are deep and real in Christendom. These divisions are deep and real, and nothing is served by pretending that they're not. Basically, I have a good relationship with different. I don't know a lot of Eastern Orthodox folks. I know some, but I've got a good relationship with different Catholics, and I don't think anything is served by me downplaying my Protestantism. I would much rather talk with. I don't want to talk with the lowest common denominator ecumenical people. If I want to talk to a Lutheran who believes in all. If I talk to a Roman Catholic, I want to talk to the guy who believes in all. I don't want to talk to the quasi-Protestantized Roman Catholic who's willing to talk to me and have us send over the quasi-Catholicized Protestant to talk with him. All we're going to do is end up in a hopeless muddle. So I believe that the rule of thumb is charity, to keep our existing divisions well tended in all charity, but not try to overcome them apart from genuine agreement on what the scripture teaches. Does that answer your question?
Well, it moves in the direction of opposite
of the
path.
Okay.
Thanks again for coming. 9:00 in the morning. We'll try to start pretty promptly because we want to get both sessions in before lunch. So see you in the morning.
You touched on the liberal arts. You did some homeschooling. Just a general position, stance, philosophy about bringing up your children in K-12.
Okay. The best thing I could say there is that I believe that Christians should bring up their children in community. So that, I think the school is the best way to do that. But for homeschoolers, I believe they need to make a point of coordinating with other homeschoolers or doing stuff with other families or coordinating with the school so that your kids grow up in a Christian community. I believe you're an isolated family in a hermit style setup is not healthy, is not good. And because it ties in with Second Corinthians 12:12, where it says, those who compare themselves with themselves are not wise. You don't have any way of getting feedback on how you're doing. How am I doing? And community teaches you that. Also, parents know their children better than anybody else. But in some areas, parents have blind spots, and parents know their kids worse than anybody else. So, one of the things that's good in a church situation is the whole community knows what's going on when kids working mom or whatever. A bunch of people see that, and that I think is a healthy check. So basically, on K-12, I would say put a premium on rigorous standards, a lot of love, and living in the community. And then for college, I would key off of what I said today, that liberal arts education is not VOTEC training for English teachers. It is education for life. And you should expect, we have one, at New Sanders, we have one degree, it's an associate's and a bachelor's. But they're both in liberal arts and culture. So you can get a degree in liberal arts and culture or a degree in liberal arts and culture. That's all you get. We don't have the elective system at all. You come to college and we tell you what we think you need to know. And it's one track. You can't major in anything. It's just a liberal arts education. And the point of that is to enable you to live as a free man or a free woman in Christ and then go to another field and discipline and get your technical training after we've taught you how to learn and how to live. So that's what... So if you went with the worldview wheel that I was talking about, New St. Andrews has got 160 students in it. We've put a ceiling and a ceiling cap of 200 students on it. We don't want to grow past 200 because we want to stay a small community so we can keep the lifestyle issues the way they ought to be, so we can have we can know one another's stories, we can be involved in one another's lives, we can maintain sound doctrine and teaching, and we can worship together. That number of students, we've got a couple of Reformed churches in our town, and that number of students won't swamp the churches. The churches can assimilate that number of students. So the whole thing is catechetical, liturgical, designed that way. So we're trying to be consistent with an embodied Christian culture.
Sam.
Doug, I've done some reading on your blog on politics.
Yes.
I think all of us are interested in politics here. And how would you instruct or feel that the church should instruct or guide its members? And how should we as Christians ourselves as individuals see ourselves in the present political situation that we're in right now? And how we need to work it out? Our local communities, our lives, and maybe even how our church should influence politics.
I think the church should stay completely out of partisan political races. So I don't believe there ought to be an endorsement of any... election laws are such that churches can't do that. But even if... which I don't think that's right. But even if those laws weren't there, I don't think ecclesiastically that churches should do that. I don't think churches should give partisan endorsements. The church is not the church of the Republicans or the Democrats or the Constitutionalists or the candidate X, Y, or Z. I do think the church has a responsibility to teach Christians to think principally, to think in terms of principles, not particular methods, to be aware of the situation we're in and to draw their own conclusions from that. So, I believe it is appropriate. I've said from the pulpit that we are headed into the next century is the century of American empire, and Christians have historically done a bad job of living in empire, and we have to figure out how to use empire for the advancement of the kingdom, and how not to be seduced by empire. On the other hand, so Paul was not down in Rome picketing the emperor's palace because he had an empire. He felt free to use the roads and use the apparatus and used his appeal to Caesar and did all that. But at the same time, he didn't equate the empire and the kingdom of God. And so I think Christians need to be taught not to wrap the Bible in the American flag. I think they should be taught to love their country here, but not to equate love of country with love of the kingdom. I don't think the American flag should be in front of the sanctuary. We need to have a clear distinction of governments there. I think we should teach on sodomite marriage as an abomination. I think we should teach on the right to life. I think sermons on abortion should not, comments on abortion from the pulpit ought not to be rare. But if you do that, then Christians who are taught that way will be astute enough to figure out who is not an option.
Take a principle and apply it to your vote.
Right. Take these principles and apply it to your vote. Get out there and vote. Use your head. Use your conscience. You've been taught, that sort of thing. And my blog is not a ministry of the church. It's Nancy and I pay for that blog space. It's me talking. So I feel free to say on my blog things that I wouldn't say in the pulpit. Did I answer your question?
You answered my question, and principally at the same time, is there anything that you, just looking at a group of folks in Mississippi that's a long way from Moscow, and obviously dealing with politics that you have locally up there, and dealing with our politics, what we have down here in our churches, which may be a little different from what you have to deal with, and also our own local communities as we deal with things. How do you see our churches affecting the lives of the communities that they live in? Should we be more or less, or how should we look at social interaction or social
activism
in our communities as a means of God using us as grace to the community?
Okay, there's some similarities and differences in terms. So speaking in political terms, I would guess that Idaho and Mississippi are probably the two reddest states in the country. And if not, they're right up there near the top. There was an election. It was an election about 4 years ago. There was an election just recently where no Democrat won any elected office anywhere in the state of Idaho in any contested election. From the governor to the senator to the congressman down to local, not one Democrat was elected to anything anywhere in the state. And it's a red
neck.
Red neck. And you've all been from Mississippi, your reputation has preceded you. And I feel safe saying Mississippi is a conservative, traditional value thing. The difference, that's a similarity. One of the differences is Mississippi is churched. Okay? It's churched. Idaho is not. But by the time America began losing its faith big time, by the time the Pacific Northwest was being settled, and it's the least churched area of the country. And so when you get involved in social activism, you've got, from my limited experience here, I think you've got a Baptist church every 300 yards or so. And that means that when you get involved in, say, pro-life activism, or you get involved in something that Christians ought to be, you know, let's say there's a referendum on some homosexual marriage thing, or you know, that sort of thing, I believe it's appropriate and right for Reformed Presbyterians to contact all the Baptist pastors, get to know them, work together with them, coordinate things with them on things of common interest in the name of Christ. I think that's appropriate, and it'll have an ecumenical side benefit. That would occur where we are on a much smaller scale because there are not nearly as many churches. Does that answer your question?
It does. I think it does. You know, there are other issues about poverty, drugs, how we live our lives. You know, how does that, you know, young men that come to your house asking for money, but right. No, how do we, as churches or as individuals, affect the degenerating society that's around us, other than living it in our vocation?
One thing that could be done is, you know, have people volunteering to serve on committees, but there's a, you know, civic committees. But there's a problem with that because some of the problems are caused by the state not being competent to address some of these issues. And if you get on the committee, you're just going to drive them and you crazy, thinking, should we be doing this or whatever. I would encourage churches to get involved in mercy ministries. Whether food bank, you know, food banks, work situations where someone can earn money to buy a meal, have some wood somewhere that somebody can chop. I had a young guy come by the church office one time, and I offered to line up a cord of wood for him to chop, and he shied like a startled pony. that was not what he was, you know, not what he was wanting. And there you can just say, sorry. But I think coordinating that sort of thing with other churches would be a good and fruitful thing, a good and fruitful thing to do. But that's another difference. Quite honestly, we don't, in Idaho, we don't have that. We, there's not, well, we don't have any cities, so there's no inner city. We don't have a poor underclass. We don't have, there's just none of that. And so you've got a situation here that, other than sympathize with you, I'm not confident to say a whole lot about.
I have a question. When you go do a Google search for Doug Wilson, you find a lot of things about slavery controversy and Southern poverty, and obviously we're in the Deep South.
Right.
This is kind of a general kind of thing, so kind of give us your take on that, or what's happened, or what your views are, or whatever.
Okay. As I've told people a number of times, I'm not a neo-Confederate, but I describe myself as a paleo-Confederate. Meaning that I believe the South was right on all the constitutional issues that led up to the war. I believe the South had every right to secede. I believe that America had two foundings. One was in 1776, and the other was the second American founding in the war between the states. So I think America was remade, refounded in the century of revolution. So the French Revolution in the late 18th century, the Russian Revolution in the early 20th, and the American Revolution, the real American Revolution, was the war between the states. And I believe prior to that time, America was a constitutional republic. And I believe after that time, we've become increasingly a modern secular democracy. So that's what I think that war was all about. If the abolitionists were right, and the institution of slavery in the South were the equivalent of the Holocaust or the equivalent of the Rwandan genocide, then constitution or no constitution, a war should have been fought to stop it. My position is that slavery is what the institution of slavery was, and where it still exists, was an ordinary human evil, societal, institutional evil, that the Apostle Paul tells us how to subvert gradually. So, and the New Testament is full of instructions on what Christian masters ought to do, what Christian slaves ought to do, and it's not go to war and kill 600,000 people. That's not what we were told to do. So, I believe that the abolitionists who fomented war had another agenda. It was not the liberation of the slaves. It was another political experiment in social engineering. I believe that racism is a deep evil. I believe that God hates it, and he will judge it along with all of his sins at the last day. So racial animosity, racial vainglory, racial spite or malice are all hated by God. So I believe that God has his grace set on the black race as much as the white and the Asians, and that the future of Africa is glorious, just like the future of South America is glorious. So I believe all that. But we're Christians, and so we should do what God says to do. If there's a social evil, and there was in the institution of slavery, we should have gotten rid of it the way they did everywhere else in the Western world. Slavery was universal throughout the Western world. Everywhere else, it was eliminated peacefully. We're the only ones that fought a war over it and killed a bunch of people unnecessarily and didn't help race relations for a century after that because of how Reconstruction went. So basically, those are my political, social convictions. Because we were involved in culturally potent evangelism in Moscow, there was a couple of guys who started going to the Gay Straight Alliance meeting from our church, and they started going in order to make friends with homosexuals and reach out to them and evangelize and, you know, do what they could. And what it did was make them mad, and so someone in the Gay Straight Alliance dug up a booklet I'd written with Steve Wilkins in the mid-1990s and papered downtown with it and made it a flashpoint issue by quoting things that I'd said out of context and made it a big issue, like I believe slavery is a positive good, like food, air, or sunshine, and that I want to redo at the Battle of Gettysburg. But I don't. So I'm a paleo-Confederate, which is different than a neo-Confederate. The neo-Confederate is the kind of guy who lives in a trailer court outside of Houston and forms a new republic every tax season. You know, the Republic of Doug. You know. Did I answer your question?
I'm wondering if you would care to make any comments, either paralleling or contrasting, with the situation we have today with mostly Hispanic but illegal aliens that are flooding the country and, at least where I'm from, are being accepted because they are cheap labor. And it sounds to me like just a replay of the pre-war day, pre-Civil War days, where you have people who need inexpensive labor and are willing to bring it in under any guise that they can, mm-hmm. but it's for business reasons, for right. profit reasons. And so I'm just wondering if you have thoughts on how the church should be responding to that.
The church should be responding to it by, was it Yeats who wrote the poem, The Second Coming? There's a line in the poem, The Second Coming, where he says, the center cannot hold, or the center does not hold. That's where we are. We are suffering a crisis of confidence in our political arrangements, in our civic arrangements, in our culture and our heritage. The center does not hold. And if you look at Deuteronomy 28, you look at cultural chastisements, what becomes the head, what becomes the tail. It doesn't matter if Congress passes a law, a strict immigration law. The border will continue to be porous. And it doesn't matter how strict the law is. What matters is there a will, is there a cultural will that can identify what we're all about, that can resist this sort of thing. And there isn't. So basically, I don't think the church ought to go lobby their legislators to get strict immigration laws passed. What I think we need to do is redouble our efforts and evangelism of Americans so that they know who they are, they can identify who they are, and have some sort of cultural cohesion. If we're just a big postmodern morass of people doing their thing, why should a border matter? It doesn't. Right? And nobody's going to respect it. So basically, I think that this is a... the fact that Hispanic immigrants are flooding across the border is a symptom of our cultural crisis, and you can't fix that with a fence. You just can't. So unless America has a great reformation and revival, I believe that we're going to see more and more of the same until we get to the disintegration point.
All right, could I follow that up with another question? You have an illegal alien in your church. How do you handle that?
I wanted to ask about that too. The OPC just passed a report. Did you see this? They say they can't be members.
Right.
And so that was new this year, is that right?
I would say the same thing. If someone says, "Hey, I'm breaking the law, and can I join? Can I join your church?" It would depend on the law. Let's say we had, what the reasons for the civil resistance were and everything. But if someone has just come across the border in order to pick fruit in the Wenatchee Valley and they came over to Moscow and they wanted to join the church, I would say you're welcome to attend. We're not going to bust you, but I wouldn't bring them into membership. And I would urge them to get things straightened out.
It's very difficult where we are because there seems to be very little will in enforcement against certain ethnic groups, mm-hmm. Hispanics and Islanders and so forth. But I happen to be working with Filipinos who are generally pretty assimilated to the culture and seem to be working and contributing and that sort of thing, but have a very difficult time getting visas. And we've had situations like that where they have felt that it's an unfair standard that the country maintains, and so they're not obligated to obey the laws of the country, and it creates quite a gray area when you're trying
to... And I'm sympathetic with that, because when legislatures make stupid laws they can't enforce, what they're doing is encouraging disrespect for the law. That's... And it's they're the ones that have precipitated the crisis by their legislative mismanagement. But behind that is our cultural crisis, because we keep electing these guys. We keep sending them to them.
Yeah, when you say the cultural crisis, do you mean just the general fact that the culture is not centered on Christ, or do you mean a certain particular problem within the culture?
When that the culture is not centered on Christ. When I was a kid in the 50s, the culture wasn't centered on Christ then either, but the culture was out of gas. We'd run out of gas maybe 50 years before, but we were still rolling. It was an inertial, so there was a center, there was a residue of Christian memory that was the center in the 50s, which is very different than the genuine Christianity that was the center earlier. So, and now, to change the metaphor from the gasoline thing, now the bank account's empty and all the checks bounce. We don't have any, there is no political solution. So when we look at the crises that are facing America today, whether it's terrorism, the conflict with Islam, unrestricted immigration, deterioration of moral standards among our people, the breakdown of the family, all of these things are profound cultural, political, national issues, and there is no political solution for any of them.
Why do you say that the next century is going to be a century of empire? It seems to me that we're not going to make it to the next century the way things are going.
So it's going to be the century of mammon, the century of empire. We are going to be there are two kinds of empire. There's ideological empire, like the communists wanted to have, and like the Muslim radicals want to have, where they're going out demanding that everybody think the same way, dress the same way, conform to a rigid orthodoxy. That's an ideological empire. Then there's a pragmatic empire, which is what Rome was. Rome was as ethnically, religiously diverse as we are becoming, and yet there was the power of commerce and power of money that kept that apparatus together for a time. It can't last forever, but I think it can last for a while yet. I think it can last for another century. But the American empire, at the end of that century, the American empire, I think, would be unrecognizable to James Madison. There'll be certain American elements in it, but I don't think I don't think the United States is going to collapse in terms of a political unit. But I think it's going to be gradually transformed into another kind of thing entirely. And Christians who live here are going to have to figure out how to subvert the dominant paradigm, how to stand against the injustices of empire on the one hand, and how to make good use of it on the other.
A 2 or 3 minute summary of what you gave Friday morning. A lot of us don't know what classical education means. I hope we'll read your books to get a deeper understanding, but the rationale behind the trivium, the eight, what they're good at certain ages, and why the curriculum is put in the order it's put in, and that's why Latin.
Our schools are classical and Christian. I think everybody understands the rationale for the Christian part, why we want education to be Bible-centered, Christ-centered, and so on. But a lot of people say, okay, I believe in Christian education, but why classical education? Classical education has two components. One is the content of what the kids study. They study the heritage of Western civilization. They study... it's a great books program in effect. So that's the content of what they study, which is not the same thing as having the kids applaud everything they read that Plato wrote.
what we do is we teach them Plato. They read Plato, and that we learn to teach them to. We learn them. We teach them to be. learn them. We teach them to be critical of Plato, how to analyze what he was saying and take it apart. Respect him, but know how to interact with him. So that's the content. We are Westerners. We're Americans. We believe that we're downstream in a river. History is not a series of ponds. It's a river. And what happened upstream from us matters. And what we do is going to matter downstream. So with regard to content, that's why we teach Latin. We teach Greek. So we start Latin in the third grade. And they take Latin all the way through high school. And then they have the option of taking Greek their senior year. So we teach the classical languages, teach the classical literature, great literature, American, British, classical, so on. So that's the content. What we mean by the classical methodology is we follow the trivium, which is grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. Dorothy Sayers wrote an essay in the 40s, delivered a talk called The Lost Tools of Learning, where she pointed out that the medieval trivium, this was her insight, her contribution, that if you applied the trivium, grammar to the elementary school years, dialectic to the junior high years, and rhetoric to the high school years, roughly speaking, that you're teaching with the grain. She called it the Paul Parrott stage of child development, the Pert stage of child development, and the poetic stage of child development. So when kids are little, they love to chant, memorize, and recite. So give them stuff to chant, memorize, and recite. You know, cut with the grain. Have them memorize declensional endings and math tables and all the stuff that you want them to just have on file. Have them memorize it, make it a game. So we have a lot of rote learning in the elementary years. Then in sixth grade, roughly, sixth, seventh grade, the kids start coming to their senses and say, and they become disputatious, they become argumentative. And they say, why are you making me do this? This seems odd. What are you doing to me? And Sayers says, when they become argumentative, teach them to argue. Right? Don't say, shut up, this is a Christian school. they're docile. They love memorizing stuff. When they love memorizing stuff, have them memorize stuff. When they become a little cantankerous and uppity, teach them how to argue. Teach them formal and informal logic. So we have our formal symbolic logic course in the eighth grade at Logan's. And they do college-level work in symbolic logic in eighth grade. Kids in junior high are good at it. That's when they learn to diagram sentences. That's the dialectical stage, taking everything apart. Then the poetic stage is where, in high school, kids become very concerned with appearances, how they're coming across. And again, Sayers, when they become concerned about how they're coming across, teach them how to come across. Teach them how to polish what they're doing. That's where we give our lit courses, American lit, British lit, classical lit. That's where we have a rhetoric course in the junior year where they give a speech at the end of the year that's evaluated by a panel of people from the community and staff. And then they do the same thing again their senior year. So they give two polished rhetorical presentations. The apologetics course is the Bible course. That's a rhetoric issue. That's in the senior year. So that's the basic methodology. Paul Parrott, Pert, and poetic. And it follows the classical trivium. And we found that it works spectacularly. It's a stupendous methodology for teaching kids how to think and how to reason and how to present themselves well. I was telling somebody earlier, for example, Idaho, like many states, has mock trial competition for high schools, which is a combination of logic, reasoning, law, rhetorical presentation, acting. People on your team have to be witnesses. You have to have a prosecution team and a defense team. It's mock trial, and when you you go through the competition throughout the state, and then the final is judged by one of the Idaho Supreme Court justices. That's argued, and we began, and we had been doing our program for a while, 20 years or so, maybe a little less than 20, and about 8 years or so, I think, ago. Maybe 10, we began entering mock trial, and within the first few years we won the state championship, and we've gone to national competitions three or four times, and placed like 11th in the nation just from a stone cold start So we've never heard of this before, and then we enter it, and the kids are just superb. They're very well trained. Yes.
I missed your homeschool and all those, but one of the disadvantages that I'm trying to figure out, at homeschool there's no competition, and especially like with my little boy, an 80% doesn't mean anything to him versus if he's in a classroom where all his buddies are getting hundreds, you know. How can you encourage in homeschool setting to still strive for the excellence without the competition, you know?
Yeah, I do. That's one of the reasons I would say try to work out cooperative arrangements with fellow homeschooling moms with another boy about the same age. And you don't want the competition to get out of hand. You know, you don't want it to become vicious and nasty. But you do want him to have to key off of other people. He needs that feedback loop. And if you've identified that he says, oh, well, you know, mom still loves me. I got an 80. And that's what you're up against. Well, that's one of the reasons why your child needs to grow up in community. So if you're not in a position to find a good school, try to make your own makeshift community of scholars through homeschooling network where you'll take another mom's kid for the history lesson and she'll take yours for the math lesson. You know, that kind of, a lot of homeschool co-ops have sprung up around the country, I think for precisely this reason, not just the division of labor on the part of the mom, but also the kids need other friends, other fellow students.
Public school, if we had somebody come to our church and send their kids to public school, what should be an approach to dealing with?
If someone comes to your church and they want to join and the kids are in the all the kids in their public school, I would, in our situation, we would welcome them, let them join. Not second class citizens, none of that. They would feel kind of odd because they'd be pretty much the only ones in the church. They would notice right off where everybody went to school, but nobody would make fun of them or jeer at them but they would expect to hear from the pulpit from time to time, the responsibility of parents to provide a Christian education and so on. But they wouldn't be disciplined or chased out, or they wouldn't get a hostile reception. Someone in that position who just thought public schools were fine would not become an elder or a deacon in our church, because we want the elders and deacons to sort of set an example on Christian ed. So that's the general response I would have.
I guess the better question would be, what's wrong? But what's the deficiency?
There is no sin. If you look up in the Bible, there is no sin called sending your kid to public school. It's just not in there. You can go through the concordance twice and it's not in there. And we have some sort of schizophrenic thing. A lot of homeschoolers, for example, say, oh, we'd never send our kids to the public school, but they send their kids to the community college to get an AA degree by the time they're 17. Well, that's a public, what's different about that? Or why is it a sin to send your kid to a public school in 12th grade, and it's not a sin to send them to Ole Miss in 13th grade? Well, Ole Miss is 13th grade, right?
It's Ole Miss.
But yeah. But that's another thing. So the issue is not Daniel went to the University of Babylon, and he wound up the chancellor of the witchcraft department. And so you can't say, I'm not saying this because of a hyper-scrupulous separatism, okay? That's not the issue. The issue is, let's say you had a father come into school and he said, you know, we homeschooled our kids through the 10th grade, and they are all godly Christians. Our kids love Jesus. They're godly Christians. They've received a thorough Christian education. I want my son to go to his junior year and senior year to the local public high school, because he's already received a Christian education, and I believe he will do more damage to the school than the school does to him. Okay? I don't have any objection to that, because that's what parents ought to be doing on the Ole Miss scenario. By the time you're going to college, you need to have received a Christian education and be prepared to take what they dish out. If you're not prepared to take it, you shouldn't be in the state university any more than you should be in the state high school. If you are prepared to take what they're dishing out and give it back to them, then it's fine for you to be in 12th grade as much as 13th grade. What I would argue is that there's no conceivable way that you could be ready to take what they dish out in third grade. But that's my argument. So in third grade, you can't possibly know what they're doing to you, because you don't have, you've not received a Christian education yet. By your senior year in high school, yeah, it's possible. You could be all checked out. And I wouldn't have any problem with a guy in that condition, that situation, having his kid in the public school and being an elder. Right? Because his kids are equipped. Does that make sense? Yeah. Our son, Nate, graduated from Logos. He then went to U of I full-time and NSA part-time. And he had real trouble at U of I, not because they were giving him trouble, but because he told me, Dad, it's like I'm prepared to fight this great battle, and it's not a battle at all. It's like tearing apart a stress ball. Yeah, like there was no resistance there. So he had a foul English teacher. Just really, and she embarrassed the football players with her language. Just foul. And she had the class, in a composition class, watch a terrible movie about an 80-year-old woman who has an affair with a 19-year-old kid, something like that. And then at the end of the movie, commits suicide. And the movie is an existential, don't let anybody tell you what to do, do what you feel, defy the authorities. That was the message of the movie. And the teacher thought this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And said, okay, watch the movie. Then she had the whole class write an essay on it. And Nate, she wanted a 3-page essay on it. So Nate wrote his essay. And the first paragraph said, you know, I used to be pretty conservative and uptight and about all these things. But I just recently learned that you're not supposed to let anybody in authority tell you what to do if you don't feel like it. And I don't feel like writing a 3-page paper. And he stapled it to two blank sheets of paper. And turned it in. It took a couple of weeks, and he was wondering where it is. And then she finally called him out in the hall. And it's pretty bad when you get called out in the hall in college. And she said, "I'm going to flunk you on this paper, and if you don't do it over, I'm going to flunk you for the course," which she couldn't do. Nate had talked to us about the whole thing before he did it. He wasn't just smarting off; he was making a point. And he said, "Well, I was making a point." She said, okay. Well, do you do see what I was arguing? He said, don't you? And she said, you can't take these things to the logical conclusion. Which meant, I want you to defy every authority but mine. I'm the only one you have to obey. And so he had that kind of trouble at the university. And he was just so exasperated with him because it was not really a fight. The reason he wanted to go to U of I is U of I was a Division I school, and he wanted to walk on the basketball team, try out for the basketball. And he had done that. He'd done the walk-on, tried out, and all of this stuff was coming to a head. And he said, Dad, I'd like to switch over to NSA full-time, just leave U of I behind. This is not worth it. This is just stupid. And
a couple other classes were as bad.
He got a royal flush. Just his philosophy instructor loved him until they got to Kant. And the philosophy instructor said, why is it wrong to murder people? And Nathan said, because Zeus wills it. It was just a curveball, Zeus. But anyway, the point was he was so exasperated. He said, Dad, I'd like to come over to NSA full-time. He was going to do both. And I said, now, you know how, this is what I was saying this morning about narrative. I said, you know how stories go. I'm telling you that if you come over to NSA full-time, as soon as you make that decision, the coach is going to call and say you have a position on the team. You know that, don't you? Because you know how things go in the movie. You just see, right? And I said, this is a story. You're in a story. The coach is going to call, and he said, I don't care. It's just not worth it. And he said, I know, he's going to call, and it's not worth it. And so he's shifted over to NSA full time, and within a few days the coach called and said, you've got a spot on the team, and he said, he explained the whole thing to him. No, I'm going to study at NSA. All of that is to say that he was equipped to, you know, he saw right through everything they were doing, and it was, it just got sick of it. But if someone else is, he was majoring in, I don't know what, communications, but if someone was getting a degree in mechanical engineering, they're probably not going to be getting that kind of grief, except in the core classes. And we're trying to set up a situation where we're fighting a battle with the state so they can get the core classes at NSA and get mechanical engineering degree or something from U of I. And so they can take all their humanities classes from us and all their engineering classes from them.
Okay, we've gone over our time limit. We're going to usher Doug outside, leave Nancy inside, make your choice.